Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Have you ever posted a photo somewhere on the internet only to find it reused by someone else on another website without your approval? It's pretty common and it's annoying, but generally the harm isn't very great. On a daily basis, there are billions of photographs being shared across thousands of public platforms, but before digital photography became an everyday technology, photo credits made careers or solidified photographers as artists whose legacies we still care about today. Sam Greenspan and the podcast 99% Invisible brings us the story of a photographer who fought for her legacy in a major art movement of the 20th century.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. You can picture her there, lying on her stomach in the dirt, arcing her camera up towards the building, tilting the frame so that the stark rectilinear building transforms into a striking asymmetric composition. You can see her taking her time with this photo, adjusting the focus and the exposure. She releases the shutter, impressing the negative image onto a glass plate. 90 years later, this photograph by Lucia Moholy is one of the most famous images of the German art school known as the Bauhaus.
Bau, meaning the word build in German, and Haus, meaning house.
Mediocre German speaker Sam Greenspan.
The Bauhaus was founded by architect Walter Gropius in 1919. The school sought to fuse art with industrialization, to use new ideals of modernism to create beautiful, functional things, which could be mass-produced for the betterment of society.
In the beginning, the Bauhaus rose from the ashes of World War I, and there was a very hopeful, very utopian period of craftsmen and artists all creating together.
This is Robin Schuldenfrei.
I teach architectural and design history at the Courtauld Institute of Art in London, but I'm American.
The Bauhaus was a magnet for European designers, architects, and artists of all kinds in the early 20th century, many of whom would go on to achieve international acclaim.
The photographer Lucia Moholy did not become one of those famous artists. She joined the Bauhaus in 1923, but not as a teacher or as a student. Her husband, Laszlo Moholy Nagy, had been hired onto the faculty of the Bauhaus, and so Lucia set off with him to become part of this new, exciting place.
Yeah, they're a young couple, right? They're young, they're in love, they come to the Bauhaus.
Lucia, like the wives of the other Bauhaus faculty, did what was expected of her, which was to do some kind of work that would help fulfill the mission of the school.
Unpaid, of course. Lucia had some training in photography.
She had the darkroom skills, and she had really excellent technical skills of the period.
So Lucia became a kind of in-house documentarian for the Bauhaus. She made portraits of the people there, of the things that they made, and of the architecture of the school itself.
Walter Gropius designed the school's campus in Dessau, and those buildings became a major theme of Lucia's work. She photographed the workshops, the dormitories, the master's houses. She set about showing the spaces where these new methods and philosophies of design were being made.
You can see the way in which Lucia's photographs of Walter Gropius's architecture expressed the same ideas that he wanted to express in the architecture itself, and this is not by chance.
Lucia's photography, like Gropius's architecture, is all about clarity and simplicity of form. It is utilitarian, documenting the world as it is. And it's also beautiful, reveling in clean lines and stark contrasts. And it's minimal, showing only what's needed and nothing more.
From the dark room in her and Laszlo's home on the Bauhaus campus, Lucia amassed a collection of 500 or 600 photographs. And she couldn't have known then the impact that these images would have on the built world or on her own life. The Bauhaus aspired to lift society up out of the wreckage of World War I and into a new world of rationalism, beauty, good art, and good design, to bring its brand of utopianism into the world at large.
But for all their efforts, the world did not become more utopian.
The National Socialist government put the Bauhaus under increasing pressure. In 1933, it was closed down by the Nazis. Many members of the Bauhaus were forced to flee immediately because they were Jewish or because they were involved in very left radical politics and they had to go.
Amidst all the turmoil of the Nazis' rise to power, Laszlo and Lucia had separated. Lucia started dating a Communist Party member of parliament. One day in 1933, he was arrested in Lucia's apartment while she was out.
So she was not able to return to her apartment because she had to fear that she was arrested immediately too. Somebody told her, "Don't get back to your apartment."
This is Rolf Zoxa. He teaches at the University of Saarbrücken in Germany, and he knew Lucia Moholy.
She had to emigrate immediately, so what she did was flee to her Czech family. So she went to Prague first. And then she went to Paris via Austria, via Switzerland.
Eventually landing in London in 1933, Lucia had left behind nearly everything she owned, including the glass negatives of the Bauhaus.
As she fled the country for an uncertain fate abroad, Lucia left the legacy of the Bauhaus to an uncertain fate at home.
Lucia weathered out the war in London. She had arrived in the city with basically nothing, and at one point lost everything again when her apartment was bombed by German warplanes.
But even in all the chaos of war, Lucia found ways to work. She wrote a book about the history of photography.
100 Years of Photography, that was published by Penguin in 1939, and at the same time she was quite a successful portrait photographer for the high society in London.
And for the most part, she put the Bauhaus behind her.
She said to me that she didn't know that the Bauhaus was more than an episode in her life. She stopped thinking about it.
At least until after the war.
I suppose that in 1946 she received the MoMA catalog of 1938. That must have been the first hint for her.
Back in 1938, completely unbeknownst to Lucia, Walter Gropius had worked with the Museum of Modern Art in New York, MoMA, to put together an exhibition on the Bauhaus. And because the war was still going on at the time, MoMA hadn't been able to get many of the Bauhaus's objects out of Germany. And so the exhibition was comprised mostly of photographs, images of the products they designed, the people who made them, and the buildings where they worked and lived. Images of the dormitories, the master's houses, the workshops.
Photos that use interesting angles to transform stark rectilinear structures into striking asymmetric compositions.
Those photographs were published in the museum catalog, the book that accompanied the exhibition. She would have seen her own photographs.
But not her name.
The 1938 MoMA catalog and other catalogs and books coming out from the U.S. do not credit her.
Again, historian Robin Schuldenfrei.
She also begins to see new articles that mention the Bauhaus that are illustrated with good reproductions of her photographs.
Following World War II, there was a surge of interest in the Bauhaus. All of their ideas about rationalism and modernism had caught on among post-war architects and designers. More and more books and articles about the Bauhaus were getting published, and Lucia's photographs kept getting circulated.
And the quality seemed to be better than you'd expect from duplications of old prints. Lucia begins to think that, just maybe, her collection of 5x7-inch glass negatives might have made it through the war after all.
And she begins to think, or to sense, that her negative might have somehow survived. So she starts to try to get her negatives back.
Lucia's first move is to write to her ex-husband, Laszlo, who had since emigrated to America with his second wife, Sibel. Lucia asks if he had any clues about where the negatives she had left behind might have ended up.
Sibel tells her that they, in fact, left these cumbersome negatives in Gropius's house, in Gropius's basement.
Gropius, completely unbeknownst to Lucia, had actually taken her negatives with him to the U.S. when he had emigrated more than a decade earlier.
Likely because he had friends who were higher-ups in the Nazi Party. And so when Gropius left Germany, he didn't have to flee in a hurry. He was able to carefully pack up his belongings, Lucia's heavy, fragile glass negatives among them, and bring them with him to Harvard, where he recently got a job.
Lucia writes to Gropius,
"These negatives are irreplaceable documents, which could be extremely useful, now more than ever."
Walter Gropius writes back,
"Long years ago in Berlin, you gave all these negatives to me. You will imagine that these photographs are extremely useful to me and that I have continuously made use of them." so I hope you will not deprive me of them.
Lucia responds to Gropius, saying basically, I never gave you my negatives.
Surely you did not expect me to delay my departure in order to draw up a formal contract stipulating date and conditions of return? No formal agreement could have carried more weight than our friendship. It is this friendship I have always relied on, and which also I am now invoking.
But when invoking friendship didn't work, Lucia hired a lawyer who wrote to Gropius that his holding on to Lucia's negatives was like a firefighter saving a house and then claiming ownership of all the stuff inside. But still, Gropius was not giving them back.
Gropius did never anything for anybody except for himself. He didn't help her. He wrote very kind letters, said, we have to think about it. We have to think about it. We have to think about it. And he did nothing.
This whole argument raises the question of who owns the image of a building. Intellectual property law on photography has evolved over the years, and it still varies by country. But generally, if you take a picture of a two-dimensional thing, like a painting, it doesn't show any artistry on your part, and therefore you have no claim to the ownership of that image.
But if you take a picture of a three-dimensional thing, like a building, you're making decisions about position, angle, lighting, framing. You're not just reproducing what's quote-unquote really there, you're making something entirely new. And so, generally, copyright on those images, that is, not just the negatives, but also the prints that Gropius would have been making from them, legally, that all belonged to Lucia.
In any case, Gropius kept making prints, kept publishing them, kept circulating her representations, kept telling the story of the Bauhaus through Lucia's photography. Architecture is, in many ways, understood and consumed through photography. We don't get to see most of the world's iconic buildings. We see pictures of those buildings.
And this turned out to be especially true of the Bauhaus buildings. Because after the start of the Cold War, the West's access to the Bauhaus campus was cut off by the Iron Curtain. Even in East Germany, it was incredibly difficult to photograph these buildings.
Yes, because there was no possibility of visiting them properly, and there was absolutely no chance of taking a photograph of them. I've been there for the first time in my life in the 1970s. I went to Dessau, and whenever I took off my camera, somebody came up and said, no, you can't photograph here, because the Bauhaus buildings at that time were surrounded by Soviet military buildings.
Photography was banned at the Bauhaus campus in Dessau from 1950 until 1980. And then later, after reunification, the buildings were altered slightly. And so, to this day, scholars like Robin Schuldenfrei say that Lucia's photographs are the best representation we have of the Bauhaus. In a way, it's like those photographs are the Bauhaus.
And so even the slides that I myself was taught about the Bauhaus in the mid-1990s, many of them were still these black and white images because they are such good quality.
After years of legal disputes, Lucia Moholy finally succeeded in getting nearly 300 of her negatives back. But
it was, in a sense, too late for her. And so I think that part of the story is unfortunate.
Lucia Moholy died in 1989. Her negatives went to the Bauhaus archive in Berlin. And it's from Lucia's photos that architects and designers drew inspiration to rebuild the post-war world.
People who rebuilt Europe drew on the ideas of the Bauhaus. They looked to its modern, rectilinear, asymmetric architecture as a counter to the buildings that the Nazis had made.
Fascism had used this kind of neoclassical aesthetic. Courthouses that were built in the post-war period in America, post offices, these buildings were all built in the modern style. And this is where the modern style does finally take off.
Our modern world owes a debt to the Bauhaus, and the Bauhaus owes a debt to Lucia Moholy, whether anyone knows her name or not. But we should know it.
Today, about 90 prints of Lucia Moholy's Bauhaus photography are housed at the Busch Reisinger Museum at Harvard. They were donated by Walter Gropius and are considered part of his archive. But the museum has, over time, actually been going through this archive and crediting Lucia on photos known to be hers.
Like the photo that Lucia took lying on the ground, pointing her camera up towards the Bauhaus building in Dessau.
So we're looking at a photo from around 1926, a gelatin silver print. It's a kind of worm's eye view. So we're looking up at this glass curtain wall And we're looking into the workshops of the Bauhaus.
Rob Wiesenberger is a fellow at Harvard who works on their Bauhaus collection.
The backside of the photo says in German in purple ink, Foto Lucia Moholy Dessau ohne Erlaubnis, Reproduktion verboten. Without permission, reproduction is verboten, is not allowed, not permitted. This was the intellectual property of Lucia Moholy.
Yeah. 99% Invisible was produced this week by Sam Greenspan, with Sharif Youssef, Katie Mingle, Kurt Kohlstedt, Avery Truffleman, Emmett Fitzgerald, and me, Roman Mars. Special thanks to Sarah Borey at the University of Edinburgh, whose research on Lucia Moholy got us started on this story. Thanks also to Jeffrey Selutnik, Gloria Ferris, Sriba Quadrivi, Jan Tishy, and Mike Wolf. Ann Wooten was the voice of Lucia Moholy, and Sharif Youssef played Walter Gropius. We are a project of 91.7 KALW in San Francisco and produced on Radio Row in beautiful downtown Oakland, California. You can find this show and like the show on Facebook. All of us are on Twitter, Instagram, and Spotify. But to find out more about this story, including cool pictures and links, and listen to all the episodes of 99% Invisible, you must go to 99pi.org.
You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories made by indie radio and podcast producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. At the same time that Lucia Moholy fled to settle in London, 5,000 miles away in Oakland, California, another movement was growing inside of a simple-looking white building right off the main drag, which was then known as Telegraph Road. Nate DeMayo and the podcast The Memory Palace take us back almost 90 years to the corner of Telegraph and 66th and reminds us how important one building can become the longer it stands.
This is The Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMayo. The White Horse Inn on Telegraph in Oakland opened in 1933 or thereabouts. No one's been able to nail down the date. Historians have tried, as have some of its various owners, it seems, over the years. But if you're not an academic, or if you don't have a personal financial stake in solidifying its claim as the oldest gay bar in the United States to operate continuously in one location, it doesn't really matter when the White Horse first opened its doors. Just that it was soon enough for a man to walk in on just the right night in 1936, or 46, or 54. And see the most beautiful man he'd ever seen in his life, and just be done for. Soon enough for another man, who'd heard of this place, heard of places like it, whispered about, or mocked by the fellas in the assembly line, or in the office, or in his usual joint across town, heard the cracks about pansies and perverts and queers, and feared what they might mean, feared why the words seemed to cut right through, sit strange in his belly and tight in his throat, but who fought through that fear to make his way there, to the White Horse, who may have circled the block all butterflies before working up the courage to park, who may have walked right past it rather than be seen walking in by some stranger, or maybe he pulled his collar up and tipped his fedora low and pushed through the door as fast as he could, and who may have learned that night in that bar, where men talked to men by the fireplace in the back, where women flirted with women in the light of the jukebox, men held hands by the pool table like it was nothing, like it wasn't everything. Knew that night for sure, that this was the place he belonged, that this might be the only place he belonged. Like it was for other women and men, those who were identified correctly as such at birth, and those who weren't, people who needed their lives to change, to make sense, to be less lonely, to be less scary, to be more fun, to be saved. In the 40s and 50s and later, men and women, friends from the neighborhood at the bus or church, friends who knew the truth about each other, would walk arm in arm up Telegraph Road to the White Horse, would play at being people they were not, and then walk through the door, into that windowless room, and become who they were. They'd go their separate ways, he to a boyfriend, and she to a girlfriend, and they'd spend a few hours in a place where so much of what they'd been taught all their lives about what life was supposed to be, about who they had to be happy, or responsible, or good, or saved, just fell apart. Just put the lie to the whole thing. The laws of the universe themselves, just torn up and tossed like confetti, to swirl in the bar light, and flit in the laughter and the dance songs, a light on the eyelashes of some pretty man, and float on the surface of a martini glass. And then they'd say goodnight to their boyfriend and girlfriend, to the people there who understood, who helped them understand, and they'd link arms and go back out into the world. Have no illusions about the world. The world did not want that man and that woman to be who they were. Gay sex was a felony. Cross-dressing was a crime. People risked imprisonment, forced sterilization, institutionalization, lobotomization for acting on who they were. If the cops, armed with laws that let them raid bars, if they suspected women were dancing with women, or men were holding hands, or speaking in high-pitched voices in some cities, if the cops came and threw you into the paddy wagon, if not threw you up against a wall, your name would wind up in the paper along with your address. You could be fired, kicked out of your apartment, lose your car loan, get beat up, or worse, by people in your own home, or by people who now knew where your home was. The laws would change. Attitudes would change. Sometimes for the better, and sometimes not. The war seemed to change everything for a while, especially there in the Bay Area. All these soldiers and sailors and nurses flooding in, away from home for the first time, discovering who they were for the first time, discovering whole worlds in windowless rooms like the White Horse. In the 60s, a straight couple bought the bar, and they were so worried about raids, it seems, and some speculate so skeeved out by their own clientele, that they instated a strict no-touching policy. No more slow dances, no kissing, no nothing. It was like that for years, but still people came to the White Horse, because it was their place. But then the late 60s came, and the hippies came, and the radicals came. Berkeley was just down the road. The Black Panther was on patrol right there in Oakland. And gay men and lesbians and transgendered people started staking more radical claims, started living more radical lives. And the White Horse embraced gay liberation. And by then it was just one of the many gay bars in the area where people could find each other, could find out who they were and who they wanted to be, where they figured out what was possible to ask from this life, where they asked for it together, as they'd done in the White Horse Inn since 1933 or thereabouts. The White Horse Inn was opened the night in 1966 when transgender women fought back against police harassment in Compton's cafeteria across the bay in San Francisco and rioted. It was still open 2 years later when the Stonewall Inn was raided across the country and people protested for 3 days. It never really stopped. It was open on the night in 1973 when an arsonist set fire to a gay bar in New Orleans, locked the door, and killed 32 people. The White Horse was there for people who needed to mourn. It was open for people who wanted to celebrate in 1962, when Illinois became the first state to decriminalize homosexuality, and 13 years later when California joined it, and 28 years later when the Supreme Court forced 14 states to do the same. It was open in 1977, when San Francisco elected Harvey Milk to its board of city supervisors, and in 78 when he was assassinated. It was opened in 1979 when 75,000 people marched in Washington for their civil rights. And it was open all throughout the 1980s, when its customers started dying, when its employees started dying. In 1 year alone, 8 bartenders, 8, died of AIDS-related illnesses. And the White Horse Inn stayed open, as it has been, again and again, when men and women, and boys and girls, transgendered people, were murdered for who they were. So many since 1933 or thereabouts, mourned by what people now call the LGBTQ community, a community built year by year, night by night, in windowless rooms like the White Horse. It was open when Vermont passed its civil unions law, when Massachusetts passed its marriage law, when San Francisco's mayor issued marriage licenses, and when the California Supreme Court annulled those unions, annulled the marriage of the manager of the White Horse, too. It was open when the California voters rejected gay marriage, and it was open for dancing when the Supreme Court threw that vote out. It was open on a Saturday in June, when someone killed 49 people in Orlando, Florida, in a place like the White Horse, where people came to be who they were. And it was open on Sunday. And it's open tonight. And it'll be open tomorrow.
That was Nate DeMayo, host of the podcast The Memory Palace. You can hear more stories from the show at thememorypalace.us, and you can still find the White Horse on Telegraph Avenue at the Oakland-Berkeley border.
On white horses, let me ride away to my world of dreams so far away. Let me run to the sun, to a world my heart can understand. It's a gentle, warm, and wonderland far away. Stars away, where the clouds are made of candy floss.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look out for The Spot under the Programs tab. There's a podcast you recommend right now. Let us know. Email thespot@kalw.org. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and thank you for listening. Tune in next week, same day, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW.
On white horses.